I'm Bob Darrell. I'm an alcoholic. Boy, it's good to be here. I'm telling you, I want to thank John for asking me. Darian, he's been a great, superlative host on the way up here from Billings. The truck, I got to know more about Darian than I ever imagined I needed to know, really. God must have thought, you've got a Darian deficiency in your life. I don't know. But we're kindred spirits, and you know, sometimes when I come to an AA event, I come and I have a really clear sense that I'm there to be useful or do something or whatever. But I've only had this experience maybe a half dozen or so times in recovery where I come to a weekend and I really get it about halfway through the weekend that I'm getting more out of this than I'm ever going to ever possibly. I don't even know what I'm bringing here. And the reason I get that sense is that there's a feeling that permeates this conference, and not a lot of conferences, but this one and a few others I've been to, where I really get a sense that I am with people that are on the same page about Alcoholics Anonymous. I get a sense that I am here with people who are in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I get a tremendous sense, you can hear that, of the love affair with AA and recovery. You can hear it in the laughter. And I've laughed. I go to some conferences where we're sober. And I'm tired by the end of the weekend, and I feel, I've been rejuvenated. I've laughed more in this weekend than I have in a long time. I've spent time with some old friends that there's been a part of me that has wanted to spend more time with some of the people I've gotten to spend more time with this weekend. And I don't know what I'm going to bring here tonight, but I'll tell you, I'm really grateful to have been here. And the conference has been exemplary up to this moment. It's been great. Your speakers have been incredible. Sterling, you can't help but catch some of his enthusiasm. And he's a great member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been to his home group. I know that what he talks about, and he does. And Linda, I just loved Linda's talk. She said something I'm going to take home with me. I've been thinking around it for a while, but she nailed it in a way that all of a sudden I connected some dots inside myself, the way she said it. And Tim, I'd never heard Tim before. We're gonna bring Tim. Tim doesn't know it. He's gonna talk in Las Vegas within the next year. He just is. Even if we gotta send Calvin and a couple guys to kidnap him, we're gonna get him in Las Vegas. I mean, he's gonna be out there. He gave a great talk. It was very, and my experiences were so much alike his with my father and I'd lost both my parents in recovery. And with some of the upbringing and we had so much in common. And I really look forward to hearing Bob tomorrow. Bob is always, I steal lines from Bob and share them with my sponsees, and they think I'm brilliant. I've done that for years. Where'd that come from? Did you think of that? Well, kind of. I heard it and then I thought about it. Yeah. But to get down to what I'm supposed to do here, I always do something before I talk, and I try to get me out of the deal here, because I'm one of those kind of guys, wherever I go, there I am, and I want to get me out of the deal. And I'm here to talk to two people. I don't know who you are, but I know you're here. You're always here. And the first person I'm here to talk to is the man or woman, for some reason you don't understand. You haven't been able to connect here like everybody else seems to connect. And you get little periods of abstinence, and then you you drink again and you don't know why, and you come back to AA and everybody in AA is doing so well, and it's all of them and then there's you, and you don't know what's wrong with you, and I'm here to talk to you because you are me. You were me for 7.5 years, and I'm here to talk to you. I don't know who you are, but I know you're here. And then the other person I'm here to talk to is the person that's leaving Alcoholics Anonymous, and you don't even know you're leaving, and you're still in the rooms. And maybe you're leaving one judgment at a time, as I have done. Or maybe you're leaving just moving yourself right out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a endless series of accomplishments and acquisitions in your life, and you're leaving AA on an abundant sled of the fruits of your own sobriety, and you don't even know you're leaving. But I'm here to talk to you because you're me also. I'm that guy. And I a few years ago, I started to understand something working with the guys I sponsor and talking in the different hospitals and institutions and doing the things that I do in AA is that I'm really, in some weird sense, I'm really talking to the me that is in you. Really. And when I love you, I'm really loving the me that is in you that I could never love in me directly. And somehow end up feeling better about myself and liking me better than I ever did. I don't know how that works, but it seems to work that way. I think that I had alcoholism, I suspect, before I ever picked up a drink. I know one thing, that I was a little bit off. And I don't know why I was a little bit off. I don't know why I had something that was just not quite right about my spirit, even as a little kid before I ever drank. It was like a freeze-dried alcoholic waiting for alcohol. And I say that, and it's not because of the family I came from. I came from a family that just adored me. They loved me. They never mistreated me, even though it was funny. I listen to Fifth Step sometimes, and people have resentments towards their parents because they were so bad. I remember having resentments towards my parents because they were so good. They were embarrassingly good. They were so square. I had friends that their parents were gangsters and bikers and stuff. And like, that's parents, you know? But I had these people that went to work every day and they had this ethic and they went to church and they were always doing the right thing. My father used to, you know, if he got too much change somewhere, he'd run back and give it to them, you know. And he was stupid, you know, right? And it's funny how I was destined to be at odds with my world no matter what my world was. I was destined because of a thing that I believe is an illness of my being, of my spirit, that the book calls a malady or illness of the spirit, that I was just a little bit off. And so eternally focused, so wrapped up in myself and feelings of not quite fitting, regardless of how much you seem to accept me or love me, there was something, there was a not enoughness about it, you know? You couldn't love me enough. My family couldn't love me enough. I think I'm like the black hole of love, you know? You just pour it on, it's like, is that all you got? You can't, right, and I never ever felt like anybody loved me enough. I never felt like I was accepted enough. There was this vacancy inside me that I think is a God hole, I don't know. And because of that, I just sort of adjusted to that as a kid. And I had friends, and I even though I never felt like they looked to some degree, I had a lot of friends. I was a reasonably popular kid, but I always felt like I was coming from behind. There was always some kind of drivenness about me that I didn't understand. My daughter, for a couple years, they thought she had ADD, and I'm listening to describe the symptoms, and I thought, I had that before it came out. I was that way as a little kid. I don't know. I was just a little different. And when I was 12 years old, the disease of alcoholism was touched for the first time by alcohol. And it was an experience that you hear in Alcoholics Anonymous all the time that changed the course of my life. And the reason it changed the course of my life is that there was a thing that happened to me as I'm drinking this alcohol with these older kids that I wanted to fit with and be a part of and never really felt like I was a part of. Always felt like I just didn't measure up. Like I always felt like I was kind of coming from behind. And that liquor got down inside of me and I started feeling so good and so a part of that the way I would be without it and without that effect from that moment on was never going to be enough again for me. And I started to live for it. And my life became a series of you know, when you're a young kid, you're 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, you can't drink every day. But I drank every chance I could. And it seemed like my life just was times of doing time and existing between parties. And the parties were the bright spot in my life. The only thing of any value to me. And it was because of the effect that I got from alcohol that was magical. I remember I'm the kid that doesn't feel like I fit very good. I'm the kid that can walk into a party and with an awful anxious feeling of apartness, like it's all of you and then there's me. And I drank alcohol and all those invisible barriers between me and you seemed to go away. And I could feel a part of God, I could shoot pool better than I could ever shoot pool when I was drinking. In the early days of my drinking, I could be funny, and I'm not a funny guy, but I could be funny when I was drinking. I could dance, and I can't dance. I could sing and play the guitar and sit in with bands, and I can't do that sober. I'll tell you, if it wasn't for alcohol, I swear, I know I would be celibate to this day. I would have never, ever hooked up with a girl. I just couldn't. I remember junior high school, going to a junior high school dance, and I went there, I had a purpose. There was a girl in my class I had a crush on, and I really wanted to go and ask her to dance, and somebody had showed me a couple dance steps, and I went there, and I stood up against the wall, you know, and I'm looking at her dancing, and oh, that awful feeling, oh, geez. And I'm trying to psych myself up to ask her to dance, you know, and I'm going, okay, I'm going to ask her. And I go, oh, man, not this song, next song. Next song come. I can't, not now. I did that for about half hour, 45 minutes, until I finally got up enough courage, walked across that gymnasium, asked her to dance, and she said no. And I got to walk back across that 7-mile gymnasium, and everybody's looking at me, and I know what they're thinking. They're thinking, oh, you pathetic loser. You know, do you ever feel like people are thinking at you? And I just go and I stand against my wall for a little while, spinning in my head, just going crazy with what you're thinking about me. And every time somebody's eyes go in my direction, it's, oh, you know, I finally bolted out of there, bolted, went home, moped like I was supposed to. Just went home, did that, felt depressed. And I'll tell you something, I'd have never, ever done that again. Except later that year, I was at a dance under the power of 151 rum and Coca-Cola. And I must admit, I was smooth. And there was a suave fair about me. And women, girls were dancing with me. They were saying yes. It was just like I was just a magnet to just people liking me. And it was just great. And if you said no, oh boy, are you missing it, man. You know, That is power. That is something that, it's no wonder the hook was set in me. And I just lived for that effect. I lived for that magic, that feeling like that alcohol put me into some flow of energy in the universe that all of a sudden I was tapped into and everything just clicked. And I was brighter than I am. And remember 3 o'clock in the morning and being deep? You know, cracking the secrets of the universe, you know. I'd say things that would blow my mind. Just, oh, man. Oh, that's profound. And, you know, and then I sober up and I'm back to being me again. And I never, ever liked that very much, really. And I pretend like I become a pretend human being, you know. And I existing in those times between parties. And I don't know that I have a disease called alcoholism. I think I have found the thing, man, the magic elixir of life. And, but there's something wrong with me. And there's something about me that when I start to drink, I can't seem to shut it down when I should. I always go too far. I always end up whacked by the end of the evening. And as the years went on, this illness, this progressive illness that I didn't know was progressive, I just thought that I was hitting a bad patch of road that seemed to be badder and badder and endless. And the ability to get the magic from alcohol, that feeling of, man, of community. Remember the feeling of community in the early days of being at a party? God, I could walk in there just with that awful feeling of it's all of you and then there's me and four or five drinks. Man, I just loved everybody. You know, I was a part of. And I started being... It started being harder for me to get that effect back anymore. And I could get drunk, and it seemed like as the years progressed, my ability to obtain that sense of ease and comfort, that sense of being a part of, seemed to get less and less. And I started incurring problems. And the problems as the time went on got worse and worse. And it's this tipping, this thing in the beginning of my alcoholism where it was a lot of fun and a little bit of problems. Now it's tipping the other way and it's a lot of problems and rarely do I get any fun. I mean, and it's crazy. And it was like every time I would, as the years progressed, every time I'd go out to party, it was kind of like, you know, you try to tell yourself you know what's going to happen, but I never really did. But in the beginning days, there was an illusion of control because it was like spinning a roulette wheel. And before the disease progressed too badly, when I'd go out to party, I'd spin that roulette wheel. And there were great things on that wheel. There were drag racing, there were dances, there was getting laid, there was laughing with the guys, there was singing a cappella music, there was rock concerts. There was a little bit of, you know, throwing up occasionally and a little bit of allocations with the police. But really, for the most part, this is party. This is party, party. And as the years went on, some sadistic force kind of creeping into my life and changing the stuff on that wheel and putting up wet pants and, you know, putting up that look that you get from people who love you that most people go through their whole life, never see that look in somebody's face, that look that's like a blend of pity and contempt. You know, like they're looking at you like, man, how could you do this? You were doing so good. What's wrong with you? But they don't say that. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, but they always said it in the look. I started getting blackouts and frequent. I'm a blackout drinker because when you got the phenomenon of craving and once you start to drink and you can't get enough, I always get too much. And because of that, I started incurring blackouts almost every time I drank. Not every time, but almost. That's why I gravitated a lot to drugs and stimulants. Not because I like stimulants. I just like to have an illusion of control more in my drinking where I wouldn't black out as much. And I can remember things because if you're a blackout drinker, it's a frightening world out there. Are there any blackout drinkers in here? Could I say, oh, okay, my people. It's hard going through life when other people know more about you than you do. It's a hard deal. And I never did, you know, I never did anything good in a blackout. Nobody ever came up to me the next day and said, oh, Bob, you were so helpful last night. You peed in our kitchen. You hit on my wife. You broke my lamp. You stole my stash. You sideswiped my car. You passed out on our front lawn. You told everybody last night you beat Bruce Lee in a karate match? You know, and you hear that stuff the next day because they're waiting to tell you. There's an element in the world that just lives to tell you that stuff. They just seems to be Christmas morning for them when they can find a guy like me and tell them what you did the last night. Watch that look on your face. You know, they just live for that. And so I hear that stuff and I just want to crawl under a rock and die. So I start drinking over the things I've been doing when I'm drinking. And that is a squirrel cage. They say there's no such thing as a perpetual motion machine. I'll tell you, that is close. Because now I drink and my behavior is bizarre and it's shameful. And I sober up and I have to drink over what I did when I was drinking to create more behavior. I have to drink over. And this is a snowball coming down a mountain that's getting bigger and bigger. And they say they call it the progressive disease of alcoholism. And I can't stop. And it's not because I didn't want to stop. I I went to a lot of detoxes. I went to a lot of treatment centers. I went to some of the finest psychiatrists on the planet. My father was very politically connected. He was a very, very respected man in government, and I had a lot of juice, and because of that, he got me in to see some therapists. I mean, they'd written books and started movements and stuff. You weren't even going to see them unless you were a movie star. And I did some great work with them, but nothing ever changed. Because no matter what epiphany experiences I can have in therapy or in these weekend sessions where they don't let you sleep and you'll emote and beat pillows all weekend, no matter how much I get to a sense of, oh, I've changed my life, within no time at all, the shine of that wears off and I am back to being me. Right? Back to being the guy that there's a big hole in the center of my being that just drives me frantically. And I don't know what it is. And this, and Silkworth says it best. He says, guys like me, when we don't drink, we become restless, irritable, and discontent until I can again experience the sense of ease and comfort I'd once found in taking a few drinks. But the problem with that is you can sit me down and tell me when I'm sober and dry for a period of time I'm that way, and I don't get it. Because the restless, irritable, and discontent is not big restless, where you're like, need to be in a straitjacket restless. It's not big irritable, like I'm just fighting with people all the time. And it's not big discontent, where I'm like in deep, deep depressions. It's just low-level stuff. Kind of right below the horizon. It's just a gnawing, inability to ever get settled anywhere. A gnawing inability to ever really enjoy myself sober. As it says in chapter 11, that these guys like me, we drink again for the basic reason. We drink again because I'm not happy about my sobriety. And I can't imagine life without alcohol. And what happened to me is what it talks about in the next couple lines. It says you'll get to a place where you can't imagine life with it or without it. You will know a loneliness such as few do. You'll be at the jumping off place and you'll wish for the end. And that started to happen to me. I started into the bleak years of drinking. And when I say that, all the glory years were behind me. And all I had was a delusion that I could recapture that. And it was like this psychotic wishful thinking that all the evidence is that now the drinking is really bad. But I start to imagine it's going to be like it was when I was 20 years old again, even though it's not. And I started that. And my drinking has taken a turn where I drink and I'm not laughing and carrying on having a good time. I'm not a part of anymore. I'm the guy that drinks and feels sorry for himself, that goes on crying jags, that falls down, that you don't know, you don't want to drink with me much because I drink frantically and you don't know what I'm going to do. You don't know if I'm going to be kind of just a bump on a log and drink myself into oblivion or if I'm going to flip out and put my hand through a plate glass window and you're ruined. Your whole evening is ruined because you got to take me to the emergency room. You don't know what I'm going to do. And this is not fun drinking. This is pathetic, self-pitying drinking. And yet I get sober over and over again. And every time after a period of abstinence that feels like I'm doing time, I start to imagine that I can drink like I drank at one time, even though the evidence and experience is overwhelming that those days are over. I start romanticizing that I can get that back because I'll tell you something, I need to get that back. I yearn to get that back. I'll give anything to get that back because without that, I'm nothing. And that's been my big secret all my life. I'm nothing. And so I go in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous and in and out of institutions. One time I tried everything there was to try. I was in this halfway house and I can't even tell you how many relapses I've had up to this point. And this is no fun anymore. And I really want to turn my life around. I got guys I went to high school, they're buying homes and have businesses and stuff. And I'm like, I didn't think I was homeless. I wouldn't have told you I was homeless. I was an urban outdoorsman actually, but I didn't have any place to live. I mean, I lived on people's couches or in halfway houses. I mean, I had no place to live. My parents by this time don't want anything to do with me anymore. They've spent fortune trying to help me. They pulled all the strings they could pull getting me help and they've given up. And I'm in this halfway house, and one of the counselors that's running the place, I'm talking to him, and he knows I'm not doing very good sober. I'm depressed, and it looks like clinical depression, but it's really not. It's a, because I sponsor a guy that has clinical depression, and his thing's a little different than mine. But I could see how these guys look at me and think that I'm clinically depressed. But what I really have is the depression of the obsessively, overly self-involved. I just get my life and my emotions right here, and that's all I see. And everything else in the world is so, yeah. It's just, but it's me. It's me, and it's my feelings. And the more I focus on them because I'm drawn to them like a stone in your shoe, the more I'm drawn to them because they just gnaw at me, because they're not right, the bigger they get, and the more empty and vacant my life seems. And I go to this psychiatrist, and I'm thinking, man, I got this. I got to try again. This guy, he's a doctor. He can maybe help me. And I started to tell him about how I feel. And I was sober a couple months. And I remember him looking at me, and he's nodding his head and he's smiling. And he says to me, the counselors from the halfway house had sent me. And he said, you know, you got this little job. And he says, you know, those people really don't appreciate the sacrifice and what you're trying to do here by not drinking. And I started warming up to this guy, man, I'll tell you. And I said, yeah, you know, and he says, this is hard for... you've destroyed yourself with alcohol and combinations of drugs and alcohol, that you're not in a good spot, and nobody understands that, but I understand that. And he said to me, there's no reason you have to feel that way. We have some medication that's designed exactly for you, for people like you. And he reached over and he grabbed his prescription pad, and I started feeling better instantaneously the minute he grabbed that prescription. I'll tell you, if I could have done it and had some finesse about it, I think I would have run around his desk and kissed him. Because I got hope, and it was like, you know, it was the same feeling you get when you're really doing bad and you're hungover and you're sick, but you got the bottle, you just haven't got somewhere to crack it yet. Just having it makes you feel better. You know what I mean? And it's like that. And he's given me something, and I don't know what he's given me, but he's given me something, and this is good. And what he gave me was good, and it did kind of take the edges off and the extremes out of my life, but with the a little bit of emotional relief also went my desperation. And I can't stand here and tell you that maybe I would have been broken enough by my pain and depression that I would have had to surrender and get a sponsor and everything. I don't know that, but I'll tell you what it did do for sure. It gave me enough relief, just a little bit of relief from all of that, that I didn't even have to entertain it anymore, that I have to join you, really. And what another thing about me is I've always been, this is probably not true of everybody, but I've always been the kind of guy, if you give me a little bit of relief from my emotions, a little bit of relief has never been enough for me. And I always want, you make me feel a little better, yeah, that's good, come on, right? Because now I know that there's more coming. It's like, I remember in this history course, we were talking about revolutions. So this is actually a social science course. We're talking about revolutions, political science. We were talking, and the professor said something that was very interesting. He says social revolutions, the big dramatic change, upheavals in society, never happen when the people are at the most oppressed. It's always after somebody's come along and given them a little bit of relief from the oppression, and they go, oh yeah, let's come on, let's go get storm the castle. You know, and that's kind of what had happened to me. I just, oh yeah. Then I'd start fantasizing, you know, the good old days when I could meet some girl in a bar, and you know, all that stuff would start coming back to me, because I still feel like a bump on a log, really. You know, because I suffer from a disease called alcoholism that really begins where the bottle and the bag ends. And I didn't understand that for a long time. It was confusing to me because people in Alcoholics Anonymous and people in treatment centers seemed to say to me, your problem is alcohol and all that other stuff. If you just stop doing that, you're going to be fine. And I would stop doing that, and I really wasn't fine. I really wasn't fine at all. But so I'm a pretend fine guy. I'm the guy who talks about in a vision for you. Work better, feel better, having a better time. Then I want to go back to my bunk in the halfway house and just feel depressed, and I feel awful and lonely. And the loneliness, I remember the loneliness probably more than anything. It just seemed like at times I was just overwhelmed with loneliness. And a loneliness that nothing could seem to really alleviate, because I could get into a relationship and within no time at all, the shine of that would wear off and nothing has really changed. I'm still me again, you know, and so I drink, and I drink because I get backed into a corner. I'm the guy that no matter how tremendous my resolve is not to pick up a drink, no matter how much I've made up my mind, no matter how I've been educated about the evils of alcohol for guys like me and what will happen to me if I drink, my resolve is always worn away by the vacancy and the emptiness and the low-level depression and the feelings of anxious apartness that I experience in sobriety that goes right below the horizon, that just sort of gnaws at me in a way that I can't really talk about because I don't know what to talk about. Because if you ask me, well, Bob, what's wrong? I don't know. It's just that nothing's right. And I, you know, oddly enough, I would drink again. Not always, but a lot of times when my life was better than it had ever been. I could come out of the bushes or out of the county jail and get into some halfway house, and in 6 or 8 or 10 months later, I got a car and a girlfriend and a good job, and people are starting to like me again and trust me a little bit, and things are good. And out here, it looks like Bob's doing good, and it looks like Bob's life is becoming more manageable. But the real unmanageability has always been on the inside. It's always been in my emotions, in my thoughts, in this head that spins uncontrollably about stuff, and a mind that just seems to just work on me. I sponsor a guy that has a very hyper active ADD kid that's just is like a Tasmanian devil. I mean, he's like, you know, don't put that down. No, don't touch that. You know, it's just crazy like that. And I've went over to their house and I spent about 2 hours with him, and they're listening to the, you know, them yelling at the kid and just don't do this. And I was worn out. And I think that's like living with my mind when I quit drinking. It's just, and, you know, they don't like you and this job isn't going to last. And, you know, it's no wonder I'm a guy that walks around, people say, how you doing? Hanging in there. Well, it wears you out. I mean, because it's just all the time. And I finally got sober in 1978 after going to jail and being running into a kind judge that I resented, who sentenced me to some time in prison, and then kind of gave me a break and said if I did certain things, he reduced it down to a misdemeanor, and I had to go into a halfway house and stay there for a year and get good UAs and make restitution, all some stuff I wanted to do with everything in me, because I don't want to ruin my life anymore, and I don't want to do 2 years in prison. I'm not good in prison. I'm not a guy like that, and I couldn't stay sober. I eventually drank again. I tried to take my own life on my last run. Not because I'm a suicidal guy. I'm not a suicidal guy. But you back me into a corner and you put me in a place where drinking is awful and not drinking is awful. Suicide can start looking like a good deal to a guy like me who's not even suicidal. But I'm running out of choices here. I'm getting backed into a corner and life is untenable. It's impossible. Because I can't jumpstart the party and I can't live without it, and it's bad. And I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous in Las Vegas. I had to split the place I was in. I knew there were warrants for my arrest. I didn't know what was happening. I was on the run. I ended up in this hospital, and something happened to me. And it wasn't until a while later that I heard a speaker named Chuck Chamberlain talk that I understood a little bit what maybe had happened to me. And I didn't do it. And what had happened to me is that I'd been surrendered by the bottle. I had been broken to a place that I did everything to avoid going there, that place of hopelessness, because my great fear is if I really give up, if I really let this thing beat me, what will happen to me? So I fought it, and I went to treatment, and I went to everything I could trying to shore up my life, and when I was broken at the end. And because of that, I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in this detox, and I think when you're broken, the view is different. And I sat there, and I had sat in hundreds of meetings, but for the first time, I started to actually hear you. The thing that used to put you down in my head, that little narrator that would talk over you and, you know, listen to this guy. Oh, my God, what a phony show. You know, that thing, right, that was seemed to have been gone. And I sat there and I actually heard you. And I sat there and I'm nodding my head and I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God, I'm like these people. And I watched them. They came in. The guy that was my first sponsor, and he's in my life, and I love him dearly. And he's a great man, Dick. He used to come in there. He was a very, very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous in those days, and he would come into those meetings, and I would listen to him, and I would watch him, and he laughed a lot. And I was sober, and there's nothing funny. I'm not having a good time. And he is something that I never understood, but yet I'm getting it that I'm like him. And what he is, he's happy and sober. I don't get them in the same person at the same time. I get happy, I get sober. I don't get happy and sober. And he's happy and sober, and he's got a vitality of life, and he's successful in seems like everything he does. He's like there's some kind of flow working in his life. There's something clicking since alcohol stopped working for me, I haven't had in my life in years. And I asked him to be my sponsor, and I started following him around and doing everything that did. And I was a high maintenance guy in my early days of sobriety because I didn't really, really work the steps out of the big book until I was in my fifth year of sobriety. When I did that, it turned me around. I've never been the same since that. I went through the steps of the kind of a BS, almost a treatment center version when I was in newly sobriety, and nothing really changed. So I'm a bad case in early sobriety, but I stay physically sober because I go on a lot of 12-step calls. I go into the hospitals. I go to 15 meetings a week. I go to coffee with people because I can't be alone with me. Because I'm alone with a crazy person that's really not on my side. You know what I'm saying? I immerse myself in activities in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm able to stay physically sober, but I'm crazy. And I would call my sponsor up almost every day, and I'm just every day I'm nuts about something. Every day it's this job, you know, they're looking at, I don't think they like me, and I'm going to lose this job, and I don't know where I'm going to get another one, and I'm going to be homeless, and I don't know if I can do homeless sober, and they're going to catch me, and I'm going to have to go do 2 years in prison, I think, eventually, and besides that, I got a brain tumor, I can feel it, I know it, it's just going, and he'd go, whoa, he'd go, whoa, he says, is everything okay right this second? Yeah, but by the end of the month, man, I'm going to be out in the streets. Yes, no. Right this second, is everything okay? Well, yeah. He says, good. When it's no longer right okay, right this second, he says, you and I are going to have something to work with here. But let's stop cleaning up the wreckage of your future. Let's stop solving problems that haven't occurred yet. And what he's trying to do, and I didn't get this he used to tell me that over and over again, bring me right back to now. Right now is everything all right. And what he's trying to do is to bring me to the only place I think I can find God. It says in chapter 5, it talks about a place where you'll find God. It says, there is one who has all power, that one is God. May you find him in a place that most of us seldom visit. May you find him now. Right? See, some of you are laughing. Even as I'm saying that, I can tell by the look in your eyes, you're not even here. You're thinking, what page is that on? Who can I tell that to? I mean, you know, right? Because you're like me, right? I live in a cognizant reality, but I'm never really here. You know what I mean? Right? I live up here. No wonder I didn't feel like I fit out here. I ain't out here. Shit, I'm up here. You know, right? No wonder I don't fit like out here. I'm self-involved. I'm up here all the time. And I was a high maintenance guy, and I had a lot of depression in early sobriety that I struggled with. Because I am self-centered by nature, which means that I have this obsessive inclination into myself. when I just don't get into my feelings, I drink of my feelings like I did alcohol. I can't, it doesn't matter that it's hurting me. I haven't had enough of it hurting me yet. I want more and more. And I can be sitting pondering my life and it's awful. And the more I think about it, the worse it is and it's terrible. But I'm a victim of a delusion that it talks about in the big book that I can wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world by managing well. Which means I think somewhere I can think myself out of my problems. I can think myself out of a bad emotional state. I can think myself out of a depression. And I can't because I've tried. It's like it's like digging yourself out of a hole. You just go deeper. And what's necessary is action. I can act myself out of that hole, but I can't think myself out of that hole. But I don't know that. So I'm still a victim of this infatuation with managing myself out of this by my own thinking. And it would get so bad, it's like a consciousness-changing state for me. It's like I took something. I remember calling up my sponsor one time. I said, "Oh, man, I feel awful." He says, "How long have you felt like that?" "I've always felt like this." He says, "You were fine a couple nights ago with the home group." I remembered being laughing a couple times. I said, "I must have been in denial." But it seems that way. It looks like it gets a hold of me, and it looks like I've been that way forever. I'm always going to be that way. And when I'm like that, I want to draw conclusions about my life, and they are depressing conclusions. And one night I come home and I've been to two meetings that day. I had prayed, I had called my sponsor, but I hadn't worked the steps yet. And the people in AA are hammering me to go on 12-step calls, and I go, and I go into the state prison, and I go into the detox, and it doesn't really seem to help. My life is still crap, and I'm sitting there, and I feel useless, I feel hopeless. I have a little job making barely, just a little bit over minimum wage, and it's never going to go anywhere. And everybody in AA is doing better than me, and I'd get dumped by a girl, and no one's ever going to love me, and I'm going to be alone forever. I'll probably get old and be sick eating Alpo in a old folks home alone, I just go. I drink of this stuff like whiskey, you know what I mean? I just take it to the wall. I mean, I'm just that kind of guy. And I'm sitting, and I'm so depressed, I can't get off the sofa, where your whole body just is bad. I mean, like I weigh 1,000 pounds, And I don't know what to do, and I don't like this. This is not fun. And I want to get out of it, and I'm scared. And I said, "God, please help me." And I looked at the clock, and it's about going on 10 o'clock. And there's a meeting at a place called Duffy's. It was the old In-Between the Shows group. That met at 10:15 on the strip, and it was not too far from my apartment. And I muscled my way off that sofa and shuffled out to my car like a mope, and got in my car and drove to that meeting. And there was a parking space right in front of the door of the chapel, underneath the billboard right there. And it was nice; it was underneath the billboard, so that the pigeons could decorate my car during the meeting to match my mood, And I went into the meeting, and I sat in the back of the room, when you're like that, you don't really listen, because the big show is on the inside, right? And I'm not really hearing what's in the meeting. It's just like music in a doctor's office, because I'm thinking about my life. And there's a guy in the back of the room that's kind of keeps breaking my chain of thought and drawing my attention, and he's coming off a drunk, and he's in bad shape. And he's sitting there, and he grabs himself, and he's rocking back and forth like he wants to jump out of his skin. And he can't sit very long, and then he gets up, and he's pacing right behind me like a caged animal. And then he's going into the bathroom there, and you can hear him in there dry heaving, and he's in bad shape. And I tell you, this guy's annoying the crap out of me. I got problems in my life trying to figure out stuff. But the meeting's over. I have heard nothing in the meeting. I have heard nothing in the meeting. I just so wrapped up in me, and I stay after the meeting to help this guy Charlie, who's the secretary of the meeting, and set the chairs up, because I've been taught to do that stuff in AA, and I'm doing it not with enthusiasm. I'm doing it like a mope, and I'm doing it. And Charlie and I are the last two guys to leave the chapel, and we're standing in the front door, and he's locking up, and Charlie has to go to work. He works at one of the casinos on the graveyard shift. He's on his way to work, and the guy that was coming off the drunk is laying on the ground in front of my car. Now, I will have to step over him to go home and think about my life, which I would probably have been willing to do. But Charlie's standing there, and Charlie's pointing at this guy. He says, "You got to help this guy." And I'm looking at this guy, and I'm looking at Charlie, and Charlie's got a big mouth. If I don't do something, he's going to tell everybody, and, hey, what a lousy member I am. And I go over to the guy, and he's peed his pants, and he smells, and he's scared because he's afraid he's going to go into seizures. And they had shut down this place called Starting Point, and they hadn't opened this other place called West Care yet. So there was a period of time in Las Vegas that if you did not have medical insurance to go to the care unit or one of those places, and you needed detox, and you were in a lot of trouble. And we sometimes would, in teams of guys, would sit with people and give them a shot of vodka and orange juice, you know, every hour to kind of bring them off. But I couldn't do that. And there was only one other alternative. And I'd been down this road before, and it was a bad road. The county hospital were required to take a certain number of indigent patients because they got some government money, right? But they didn't like it. I'd been down there with guys before. And they treat you like a redheaded stepchild. I mean, they just make you wait in that waiting room, sometimes 5-6 hours, because they don't want to deal with you. Because they, from their experience, they want to treat what they believe are really sick people, not these people that are going to be back here again in a month. So they have that attitude towards you. But I got this guy in my car, and I'm driving. I know what's coming. I know I got the whole evening down at this county hospital in the waiting room coming. And I'm driving down there, and I'm angry. You know, I'm thinking to myself, you know, isn't it enough that my life is crap? And I have to do this too? Doesn't anybody else step up to the plate in AA except me? You know, I gotta go to work in the morning. I'm gonna be tired. I'm gonna have a bad attitude. I'm gonna probably lose that job, but it's a lousy job anyway. But I'm not saying this to this guy. I'm just thinking, you know, just thinking. Driving down there, you know, and we get down to the emergency room, and we're sitting in the emergency room waiting room, and I'm giving. I tell you, you could smoke in those days in the waiting rooms. I'm giving the guy cigarettes and. And I'm going to the vending machine. I'm getting these little cans of orange juice. And in those days, we'd give guys sometimes, we didn't know what else to do. We'd give them orange juice and honey, you know. But there wasn't any honey, but there was sugar on the coffee deal. So I went and I get the sugar, I put it in there, I'd shake it up, give it to him. And we're sitting there for hours. And the guy starts telling me, and he's telling me about himself. And he starts telling me about the shame and the guilt that he just can't seem to get drunk enough to wash away for the things he did to his mom and dad and some of the women in his life that tried to love him. And he tells me about how he's been thinking about killing himself, but he's just such a coward, and he doesn't have the guts to do that. And then he says something that really hooks me. He says to me, he says, "You know, I don't know why you're wasting your time with me. You see, I'm not like those people in AA. I always drink again." And he's telling me about me. And somewhere in the wee hours of the morning, I fell in love with this guy. I don't know why. I mean, he can't get me a better job. He can't do nothing for me. This guy's probably not even going to stay sober a year and give me some kind of credit for something. I mean, this guy has nothing to give me except that he suffered from alcoholism exactly like I'd say. He was telling me my story. And I didn't know, and it was many years later, looking back on that, that I realized that what I was falling in love with is I was falling in love with something I could never love directly. I was falling in love with the me that is in him, right? And they finally checked him into that hospital, and they gave him a bed in the wee hours of the morning. The sun's getting ready to come up, and I'm driving home, and I'm crying. And I'm crying because I don't know that any other time in my life up to that moment I ever felt more useful, more complete, more right about my life, and more of a sense of purpose and usefulness than I did at that moment. And I understood why the old timers had been hammering me to go into the trenches and work with these guys and go on 12-step calls, because they knew that even the self-obsessed, self-absorbed, self-focused, narcissistic person that I was, that if I stayed in that arena long enough, one day I would turn the corner and I would become other-centered, even the bad case that I was. And I tell you, I got my purpose that evening, and I tell you, from that day to this, I've never looked back. I know that that's why I'm alive. I forgot that for a little while when I was about 17 or 18 years sober. I got seduced by the fruits in my own sobriety. I don't know how this even happened to me. It was not a cognizant thing. And I started moving away from the guy who existed to help God's kids and help other drunks, where that was the purpose of my life. And I started still doing that, still taking the actions, but inside me, I became the guy who my primary purpose wasn't helping other drunks anymore. My primary purpose became me. And it became my toys and my life and my finances and my sex relations and me, 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 me. And I started having a rough patch of road in the middle of an abundant life, a middle of a life beyond anything I could imagine. Every toy I could ever possibly want, everything I ever wanted, I got, and it was never. There's something about me when I am the center of my life, and my life is about filling my holes. No matter what you bring, no matter what I obtain or get out of life, the shine will wear off of it so quickly. I remember being depressed one day, and I just came back from a trip to Maui, and I stayed at a great hotel on the beach, and it was wonderful. And I rented a Harley for the week and rode around the island and went to the best, some of my favorite gourmet restaurants. And I came home and I had two motorcycles, custom bikes in the garage, and a brand new Jaguar and a BMW and a Corvette. And I hate my life. There's something wrong. And I couldn't have told you what it is. It's just, it's that I am the center of it again. Right? And I went to a meeting and a friend of mine straightened me out with a throwaway line. I told him, I said, I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm going to the meeting. I still go to meetings. I haven't left AA. I still sponsor guys. But yeah, I'll tell you the kind of sponsor I became when you're the center of the universe. Here's the kind of sponsor you become. The guy comes to you with a problem. It's like, yeah, get it over with because I want to get back to the important stuff. Me. Right? And so I become the short fuse sponsor. The guy that's like, you know, okay, good. Back to me. I became that guy. And this guy said to me, he said, you know, you run your mouth a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous and you do a lot of stuff out here. He said, but inside you, I don't think your primary purpose is helping other people. He said to me, and it nailed me, it hurt my feelings. He said, your primary purpose is you. And I knew what he said was right. And I don't know how to do that. And I didn't put myself in that place because I'm trying to be a bad guy or because I'm stupid. I have a natural magnetic draw to me. It's like I keep getting drawn back to me in my life, like you get drawn to a stone in your shoe. It keeps pulling your attention to yourself. And that's the way it is. I keep, and without diligent action and serving an ethic and a purpose greater than myself, I will always serve myself because I believe I am compelled to serve something. And I either serve a purpose greater than me or I will serve myself. And I'll tell you something, if you're like me, if serving yourself made you better, I would be up here saying, telling you ways to serve your, manage your own life better. This wouldn't be AA. It'd be like an Anthony Robbins kind of deal. You know what I mean? We'd be telling you how to manage your own life better, how to wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world. But we don't say that at all. Matter of fact, we say the opposite. We say things like when you're really running the show, we say things like, so how's that working for you? You know, I mean, really. And it's fun. How can a guy like me? I don't know. I'm not below average intelligence. I don't know why I can come to Alcoholics Anonymous and then get that and then not get it for a while. But that happens to me. I get it and then all of a sudden I don't get it no more. What happened to me getting it? I used to get it. I don't get it no more. And then I got to crash and burn again, right? And then now I get it. Oh yeah. Now I remember. Yeah. And that's a lot like drinking. You know, I had to hit the same kind of bottoms with all kinds of stuff in sobriety that it was just that are very similar to drinking. You remember how you would come off a run and you'd really understand why you're never going to drink again and this is really bad? And then you don't remember that until you're in the middle of the next run and you're going, oh, it's starting to turn on you again. And it's like, how come I couldn't remember this? Right? And I guess I'm that way. I don't know. I'm a member of a group in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you ever come to Las Vegas, please join us. You will find a lot of enthusiasm there. I seem to attract guys to me that are sick like I'm sick. In the big book, there's a promise in there that says that God will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. I would have never even admitted to anybody I crave fellowship, because I hid behind a lot of bluster of I don't need anybody. But I'll tell you, I was a lonely, depressive guy that wanted to be a part of desperately all my life. I really did. And I could hide behind the bluster, even in Alcoholics Anonymous. My first few years, I had untreated alcoholism, being a bad case till I got into the steps my first 5 years. I remember a guy coming up to me since accusing me of having my sense of humor surgically removed in early sobriety. I've used that ever since. I've waited patiently for sponsees I can use that on. And they show up. They show up. And I've been through some rough times in sobriety. I really identified with Tim. I buried both my parents. My mother was a hard thing to go through. I was 17 years sober when my mother became terminally ill. And I would have told you that I had made all my amends to my mother. And there was stuff to do that I have never imagined. And a guy told me to keep, as I go over and try to help my mom and take care of her as she was dying, to keep my eyes and ears open and try to listen to that thing inside of me and act on whatever comes out. And I remember sitting at my mother's bedside, and she was dying. She was almost 50 pounds. It was right before she died. And I started crying, and I said to her, I said, when I was a kid, I was asthmatic, and I outgrew it. But when I was asthmatic, I was very sick, and my mother sat with me for hours and hours and took care of me. She was like an angel. And I remember sitting by her and crying and telling her how I'm just so sorry I have a life that robs me of the ability to take care of you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, like you used to take care of me. And I thanked her for that. I had never thanked my mother for that. I just somewhere had a sense of entitlement to her care and love that I never really appreciated. I never said. And I sat at her bedside and I thanked her for that. And and she died. And it was a horrible way to go. And it was bittersweet. It was the sweet part was that I was in her life and I was there. And but it was hard to see a woman who I really identify with, who had been so proud, who always held her hand up. It was almost aristocratic and very kind and poised, and watch her till she have to change her diapers and she can't eat and she's just wasting away and she was always very embarrassed by her condition. And I loved her for that. I loved her for that because that's me. I would be embarrassed if I was that too. I would feel the same way. And I loved her. I'm loving them. I am in my mother, and I'm loving that part of me. I am her. And Alcoholics Anonymous through the steps is especially step four. You've done something to me that I've never been the same. You showed me through this fourth step process, and especially what it says on page 66 and 67, you gave me the method to start to dismantle the judgment machine that is really the essence of my will. And prior to doing that, I was the guy that would daily, frantically offer my life and my will to God, but I really was retaining my will, which is my judgment of the world, how my life should go. And so I used to say things in meetings like, I don't know why, I turn it over and I take it back. Well, I never turned it over. I turned my life over, but I'm retaining my right to my own judgment of my life and the universe and what's right and wrong and how things should really go. And if you turn your life over to God and retain your judgment, what it's like saying, God, here's my life, but there's a list coming of how it better go. And you know what depression is? That's when God stops doing your will. I mean, really. I mean, and then it's the, and it's never, and I'll tell you something, I can't always see this when I'm in the middle of a tough spot in the road, but I can see it very clearly standing right here today, that every tough, rough spot in the road in my life, without exception, since I turned my will and my life over to the care of God, has not been a rough spot. The rough spot has been my judgment of what was happening. Things were moving around in my life. Things were being taken from me that had to go, or things where I was experiencing. It was like all spiritual growth 101 for me. But when you're in the middle of it, and it's out of your control and out of my control, I don't like being out of control. I don't like having an unknown future. Because I got judgments about, if it happens this way, it's going to be awful. Well, maybe it is, and maybe it isn't. And how surrendered do I want to be? Do I want to give up? Do I want to be the childlike person who knows nothing? Or do I want to be the guy that knows everything? And I fit the old adage, you can always tell an alcoholic, but you can't tell him much. I mean, that's my nature, really. And the last few years, it's really helped me a lot to have a strong sponsor. And more than that, I think you could have Bill Wilson, Chuck Chamberlain, and Dr. Bob as your sponsor. And if you're not sponsorable, you don't get much out of it. I am sponsorable today. I call my sponsor up. I like and need the security of being tethered to someone. That when my back's in the corner, as it has been, I talked to Bob one time a couple of years ago. I was in a bad rough. I was in a rough spot of road. It wasn't really a rough spot of road. I was learning some great things about myself, and I was discarding some things that I needed to discard that I didn't really want to. It wasn't that I didn't want to discard them. I don't know what's going to replace them, and I don't. You know, I'm scared, and I have a good sponsor that just tells me what to do. And I want that. If I'm in a bad spot and my head's spinning, I want somebody there that's going to say, just go do this. That will remind me that I am not serving my feelings. I'm serving an ethic and a purpose greater than my feelings. And I believe, and I talk to the guys I sponsor about this a lot, I think to stay here long term, if you're really lucky, you will start to get something. And what you'll start to get is what you do here is more important than how you feel. And so, on a good day, I go to my commitment and detox. On a bad day, I go to my commitment and detox. I do these things, whether I feel like doing them or not, in my life. And it puts balance and security in my life. The last 2 years after I got out of a marriage that was very painful, there's a guy here that I sponsor this thing I have from my guys, and Clancy was there. He described my marriage as, he said it was like Bob, like watching Bob go through that was like watching Bob standing in a cold shower, shivering, tearing up $100 bills. It was a brutal thing. And I came out the other side, and I've, the last 2 years or so of my life have been amazing. And I am on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous. I go back to my home group tomorrow, and I can't wait to see some of the guys I sponsor and to go to my commitments. And I haven't gone to one of my commitments in the last 2 years with a feeling like I have to do it. I've gone with a feeling of excitement and enthusiasm. And that has not always been the case for me in my sobriety. But this spiritual program, if you knock off the two letters, a friend of mine told me this. He says, you get the word ritual. And I do this good days. I do it bad days. I do it when things are going my way. I do it when they're not. And I serve this because this is something greater than myself. And I do that not because I'm a good guy. I hope I finally learned the lesson of how painful and vacant and desolate my life is when it's all about me and I'm serving myself. And if I can keep that, and I keep that knowledge alive in my life by transmitting it constantly to the people I sponsor, and trying to be an example of that to them. And I'll tell you something, there's something to be said for sponsorship, not only having one, but sponsoring people, because there's a level of accountability in that that will bring a guy like me to the table in step six in a way I never imagined. I thought you become entirely ready to have God remove stuff out after you've been beaten half to death. I'll tell you, in the last several years, I've come to the table in step six really sincerely being ready to have God remove stuff, because I want to be a better example to the guys I sponsor. And that's, I come because I've fallen in love with them, and I've fallen in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And how could you not fall in love with a program and a set of people that you get? It's like getting a ringside seat for the greatest show on earth. I watch guys that come out of the county jail and the detox, and they're more dead than alive. And they're hopeless. And whatever we tell them can happen in their life, they don't believe us. But they do the deal, and the ones that do the deal, in no time at all, you see things that, you see them coming to a meeting and they got their kids with them. The kids that they told you a year before, they'll never be able to see, they got their kids back in their life. And then you see them with some sponsee, and they're laying the stuff on them that hurt their feelings you laid on them. And I tell you, it don't get no better than that, man. I'm telling you, that's like Christmas morning when you get to see the light go on in their eyes, and they're laughing and they're sponsoring guys. And you know, I tell you, the guys I sponsor, when they start sponsoring guys, there's something in my soul that just goes, I can feel them safe and protected as long as they continue to do that. And I get to watch that. I get to watch guys buy their first home. Homeless guys. Homeless guys that tell you things that their credit's beyond repair. Well, they don't know about the ninth step. Right? It's not beyond repair if you're willing to pay the stuff back. I mean, it's beyond repair sitting and thinking about it. It really is beyond repair. And that's what I had to do. I had to chip away at the wreckage of my past, and sometimes a nickel and a dime at a time. And I did it at a time in my life when I really didn't think I could afford it. I had no money, and I just chipped away at it because you told me to. Because I don't know what's happening to me. I just think I'm just whining to you about this. I'm never having enough money. I got to pay all these people back. And my sponsor said to me, he says, listen, stop it. He says, listen, okay, all right, I've had enough. They don't want your money. I thought, oh, good. He says, they want theirs back. Oh. And I sold my integrity. One flaky action and one nickel and a dime at a time, and I bought it back by being the guy I say I'd be, and I'm paying back this stuff a nickel and a dime at a time, so that I can eventually one day walk around and whatever gifts God wants to give me, I don't have to throw them away, because I secretly inside myself no longer feel like I have to throw it away, because you got the wrong guy, God. You got the wrong guy. No, you got the wrong guy. You got the right guy. Do I deserve it? No, I don't. Do I deserve the life I got today? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Not the guy I was. And I owe here. And I know that I owe here. And because I owe, I am always looking for ways to turn the volume up on my program recovery. I'm always looking for the next guy I can help. I have a tremendous debt here for what has happened in my life, the things that happened between me and my parents, the things that have happened inside of me to be the guy I never could imagine would feel good about himself sober on most days. To have a daughter in my life that I'm absolutely in love with, it's just this amazing relationship with her that I have. I'll tell you a little story and I'll shut it down. I used to share this years ago right after it happened, then I stopped talking about it. One of the guys I sponsored asked me to start talking about it again about a year ago. I was up 18 years ago, I guess. I don't know, a while ago. I was up in Northern California near the Oregon border, and I'd never been up there before. And it was after this, I had a whole afternoon to kill. And this guy took me to this place where they had these trees that just blew my mind. Some of these trees are like 25 and 30 feet in diameter. They're like 250, 300 feet high. And I'm walking around these trees feeling just an amazingly small, and it's so primordial. It's like, it's almost like Jurassic Park or something. And it's real. I mean, they say, you know, a mouse is just as much a miracle of God's creation as an elephant. Well, this is a forest full of elephants. I mean, this is, I mean, you get the elephant more, and I'm getting it. And this is just really a very moving thing. And we get in this guy's truck after spending about a half hour, 45 minutes walking around there. And we're going somewhere else to see some other trees that are kind of sort of the same thing, but it's a little different. And we're passing these meadows. And this guy says to me, he says, you see how you don't see any of these 300-foot trees all by themselves in a meadow? And I said, yeah. He said, you know why that is? No, why is that? He said, well, it is their nature to aspire to grow to such magnificent heights that by themselves they will easily outgrow their roots' capacity to support them, and they will literally topple over on their own magnificence, like that. And he said to me, what must happen to them is that they must grow up in groves, and they intertwine their root system into a net below the base of the forest, and they literally feed and hold each other up, and that allows them to grow into the magnificence that it is their nature to aspire to. And I thought to myself, I've always been that way. I don't mean to be. It has hurt me and almost killed me, but I've always been the guy that wanted to feel more, have more gratification, that wanted more. I wanted to take bigger chunks out of life. I've been always that way, to my almost death and detriment, until I came to you. And I started to mesh my life with you, and it started out small and with my home group and guys that my sponsor sponsored, and eventually guys that I sponsored. And because of that, you've allowed me to grow into the life that I've always aspired to be. Is it still my nature that I have this divine dissatisfaction and want more? Yes, absolutely. Does it hurt me today? Not as much. It's still there. I have a great life. I don't have to throw my life away. On most good days, I can appreciate it for what it is rather than for what it's not. I want to thank you for my life.